Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you ate nothing but a bowl of soup on Monday, you might want to dig into a bacon chip pancake for breakfast on Tuesday. And now scientific research says, go ahead. Krista Verdi, who teaches nutrition at the University of Illinois Chicago, says that people who alternate low and high calorie days lose weight quickly and keep it off. Dr. Verdi has co-written a new book on the topic. It's called The Every Other Day Diet, the diet that lets you eat all you want half the time and keep the weight off. She joins us by phone from Chicago. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In the book, you recommend eating one fast day followed by one feast day. Tell us what you mean by fast and feast in this case.
Sure. So the fast day involves something, the fast day generally involves about a 500 calorie meal. And we do ask that people eat that around lunchtime or dinner time. And then that's alternated with something we call a feast day, where people can truly eat whatever they want. And the reason that people really love this diet is truly because they feel like they're only dieting half the time. Because if you can eat whatever you want every other day, it's kind of like, it's almost like you're going off the diet every other day. And our studies show that people lose about 12 pounds in 4 weeks.
Let's talk about the 500 calories. People should eat, you know, all things being equal. Is it about 2,000 calories a day?
It really depends on someone's age. But yeah, for women, it's usually around 1,600 and then, you know, 2,000 to 22.
That's so unfair. Is 500 calories really enough to get you through the fast day? Doesn't it have ramifications?
Yeah, that's kind of a major concern. So the first study I did was really just to see if this was safe and also if people could even do this.
Mm-hmm.
So we've probably run, I've done this for about 10 years or so. I've done about 8 clinical trials using about 500 to 600 people. And we consistently show that not only is the diet safe, it actually leads to a lot of health benefits, such as cholesterol lowering, blood pressure lowering, glucose and insulin lowering as well. So it's actually protective against heart disease and diabetes risk. The diet is a bit difficult to do in the first week or so. So in terms of, you know, feeling hungry in the first week, that definitely happens. But people do adjust to the up-down pattern of eating after about, I'd say about 4 to 5 fast days. And it's the really interesting thing is we take questionnaires to see if people have energy on those days and really how they're feeling. And after that initial kind of 1 week period, people actually say that their energy levels return to normal on the fast day. And in general, because they are eating a little bit more on the feast day, so people eat about 10% more than what they would usually eat on the feast day,
mm-hmm.
so they definitely don't binge. But because of that, kind of the total calories over that 48-hour period works out to be only about a 25% kind of food deprivation without getting into all the nitty-gritties of the math. But it really works out to be almost the same as a daily calorie restriction diet. So it does seem a little extreme, but when you look at it kind of in the grand scheme of things, it kind of works out just to be kind of like mild to moderate food deprivation.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Krista Verdi. She's a author of a new dieting book. It's called The Every Other Day Diet. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You say to skip breakfast on fast day and just eat lunch. Why does the timing of the meal matter?
In general, it all kind of boils down to adherence. So we've run studies our initial question was really, you know, does it matter what time you eat that meal? Do you have to eat the meal, the whole 500 calories together? You know, can you split up the meal into kind of mini meals of 100 calories? And so what we found in running these studies is that people that chose to eat that meal at breakfast time were more likely to cheat because they got so hungry by the end of the day, so they ended up consuming a dinner by the end of the day, whereas people that were kind of randomized to our lunch group or dinner group did not actually cheat. So the other thing we found from that study is you also want to consume the 500 calories altogether. If you break it up into mini meals throughout the day, again, say of like 100 calories a piece, mm-hmm. That kind of gives you multiple times throughout the day to overestimate or basically to miscount calories. Mm-hmm. So people end up thinking that they're consuming 100 calories at each of those mini meals, but for real, they're consuming, you know, 200 to 300. So again, that kind of blunts weight loss.
Were you surprised that people didn't overeat more on feast day?
Yeah, absolutely. And that, in our initial pilot study, again, the first thing I wanted to see was really can obese people that want to lose weight even do this? And if they do, are they just going to fully compensate on the feast day for the lack of food on the previous fast day? So that's pretty much the first thing that we measured. And I was so surprised to see that, again, after that kind of one-week period, people really were only eating about 10 to 15% more food on the feast days. And we're still not sure why that's happening. We're going to run a study to see if it involves stomach shrinking. We have looked at kind of hunger and fullness hormones, mm-hmm. and we find that people are just coming a lot more in touch with kind of hunger and fullness cues on that day. One of the typical stories we get is it was the end of my fast day, and I was looking forward to making a big breakfast on my feast day. I wake up on the feast day, make this massive breakfast that I would usually make of like bacon and eggs and mm-hmm. all this stuff, and I could only eat half of it. So if there's something happening in the body that's actually not allowing people to binge on that feast day, and I think that's why the diet works.
What might the brain have to do with this? Because a lot of eating disorders are associated with the brain, they're finding now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we're measuring certain basically like leptin and PYY okay. and all these different, not to get into the nitty-gritties of it, but we are measuring hormones and how they interact between the gut and the brain and basically the signaling that's going on there to kind of shut down overeating on feast day.
When they are eating on feast day and whatever, whether, you know, at that 10% level over eating, do they think they're eating more? Do you have a sense? I mean, is the satisfaction level very high?
Yeah, so we actually have questionnaires to measure, like, hunger and satisfaction. Satisfaction starts out kind of low at the beginning of the study, but after about 8 weeks or so, people tend to feel a lot more satisfied. They're definitely not 100% satisfied, but all of them say that by the end of their feast day, they feel like they've eaten enough. You know, they don't feel deprived at all. They feel like they've eaten everything that they wanted to.
Where does exercise fit into the model? And I suppose it's a good time to ask about doctors, consulting with a doctor and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In general, just in terms of safety, I definitely wouldn't recommend this for pregnant women or people with type 1 diabetes. If you have type 2 diabetes, I definitely consult a doctor before starting this. And, you know, just in general, it's always good to talk to your doctor before starting any kind of weight loss regimen. Exercise, we also ran a study to see if people could exercise and if there was any extra benefits to exercise during the diet. We found out a couple pretty interesting things. First of all, again, people's energy level returned completely on the fast day, so people were able to exercise on the fast day. Because that was the first question I had mm-hmm. where, you know, can you even exercise during this diet? Or are you just going to feel so tired every fast day that you wouldn't want to do that? But we found that we allowed our subjects to basically choose a feast or a fast day to exercise, and they would come into the research center and we'd supervise their sessions. And, yeah, they chose feast days and fast days equally. The interesting thing we found was it's better to exercise before your fast day meal. In general, once you finish exercising for the day, you don't feel hungry for about half an hour post-exercise, but after about an hour or so, everyone tends to get this hunger surge, and you want to have that fast day meal in place after your exercise. So, you basically have a meal to eat when you get that hunger surge. So we found that people that ate after their people that ate before the exercise session mm-hmm. tended to cheat more because then they would have that extra meal. We also saw really nice decreases in fat mass, and then people were able to not only retain their muscle mass when they were exercising at the same time, but also to increase that, which is great because that's an indicator of your metabolic rate, your metabolism. So exercise helps to keep that nice and high, which can help with weight maintenance.
Here's Dan from Westerville. You have kind of a... Dan, you're going to have to turn down your radio. Dan, you'll have to turn down your radio if you want to get on the air. I'll move on. Some of the foods suggested as fast day options are pretty processed. Chips, cookies, frozen dinners. Are these really good for our health, or are you just like kind of throwing it out there saying it's really a feast day?
In general, I think that people should do a diet that they can stick to for a long time. We also give a lot of kind of health tips, and, you know, we do want people to decrease processed foods and, you know, just kind of increase their fruit and vegetable intake. But at the same time, I don't think a diet would work if you tell people to completely avoid the foods that they love. So we do say that you can have those foods in moderation. And the book does provide a lot of recipes to prepare fresh foods for the 500-calorie diet day meals. And it also does provide the more like packaged frozen foods for people that don't want to cook, mm-hmm. but or people that don't have time to cook. But in general, it's always best to have, you know, less processed foods.
When you were as you're doing these studies, are you only studying people who are obese, or are you studying different levels of overweight people?
Oh, great question. Yeah, you're actually touching on every single study we've almost ever done. So then we also wanted to see, yeah, can people just use this diet to lose like 5 or 10 pounds? That was our most recent study. And we found that, yes, people can lose, again, about 5 or 10 pounds after about 4 to 6 weeks. Weight loss is a bit slower in normal weight individuals. So with obese people, they lose about 3 pounds per week. But if you don't weigh that much to begin with, you'll lose about 1 pound per week. And those people kind of habituate to the diet in the same way that obese people do. And they do also see the same health benefits. So we have seen cholesterol lowering and blood pressure lowering in normal weight people as well.
Do you suggest people follow the diet in perpetuity?
You can basically...
Some people have embraced it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I, you know, as somebody who's a nutrition researcher, I really think that people need to find something that they can stick to for a long time. Because if you do whatever diet it is, like the low-carb diets or paleo or whatever, and then if you just go back to eating the way you were eating before, you're just going to gain all the weight back. So we have a Facebook page, the Every Other Day Diet Facebook page, where, you know, I hear a lot of stories. And there's people on that page that have been on it, on the diet for like 5 to 8 years. Some of them have lost like 100 pounds and maintained that weight loss. And I think it definitely works for the long term for some people. If it doesn't, then maybe this diet isn't for you. Because, again, I think you have to find something that, you know, suits your lifestyle that you can stick to.
From Anita, we have an email, and she asks what a 500-calorie meal consists of. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. So in our studies and in general, what we have for recipes in the book is it's usually some type of main. We do tell people to eat fairly high protein on the fast day. So something that I would like to eat is probably like a chicken breast on a salad, because that way you get your protein, and then you also have kind of the fiber and the vitamins and minerals from the lettuce. And, of course, to keep the salad dressing kind of as low as possible, because there's a lot of calories in that. So a lot of it is, kind of high vegetable, high protein meals.
We also have an email from Mary. She's been doing the diet for three weeks, and she said she gets very bloated and crampy the day right after the feast. I guess on the fasting day, she gets bloated and crampy. Is there anything that can alleviate that condition?
In general, I'd really have to see kind of what she's eating.
Yeah.
In our studies, we work with people one-to-one, and we also provide them dietary counseling. So it's probably something that she's eating, but I'm not quite sure with just that information.
Okay. Well, Dr. Krista Verity, thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me again.
Krista Verity, she's the author of The Every Other Day Diet. If you want to learn more about that, we have a link to the book on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And you can, of course, check out the Facebook page as well. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Are you or somebody you know going in for surgery? Research shows that patients who are more involved with their own care get better results. Then why? With a million questions floating around in our heads, do our minds go blank when we get to the doctor's offices? I am guilty of that. This isn't just about peace of mind. It's also about safety, according to Dr. William Robb. He's chair of the Patient Safety Committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. He joins us by phone from Chicago to talk about how to arm yourself with the right tools before surgery. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Dr. Robb, your committee is the Patient Safety Committee. Are there some real dangers that come from not asking the right questions of your doctors before surgery?
Yes, I think if you go back traditionally 25, 30 years ago, we really thought about, you know, the physician, surgeon providing the information we would need before the surgery. It was a very sort of passive one-way type of communication. 10 or 15 years ago, the interaction between physicians and surgeons and their patients began to change with the concept of patient-centered care. And we engage patients much more. We know now that for safety, actually, engagement of the entire team is really critical, and that includes the surgeon as well as all of the other healthcare professionals that are touching the patient during the entire episode of care and the patient. So the team really, and teamwork and team communication is really critical.
Is this also about peace of mind? I kind of joked about that a minute ago, but can that help the patient recover better just going into the surgery more knowledgeable?
Yes, we really know that outcomes, not only the medical, but the psychological outcomes of surgery and satisfaction from the episode of care really relate to the entire experience. There's critical information, obviously, such as certain medications or past medical experiences following surgery or hospitalization or just past illnesses that are important to transfer to the entire surgical team for your care, but also knowing that that information has been shared and that that information that is shared among all of the team members in a way in which it has an ability to positively impact your outcome has the ability to actually make that outcome better.
I want to bring in a local orthopedic surgeon into the conversation, Dr. Joel Politi. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Mount Carmel East. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ann.
So to both of you, I guess we could start with Dr. Politi. What do you agree with what Dr. Robb is talking about? And I was wondering, what are some common questions people should ask but often don't?
Yeah, so what he said was really spot on. You know, setting people's expectations before surgery and having them be prepared in both a mental and physical way really has been shown to improve their outcome dramatically. So questions that we try and anticipate. So in orthopedics, a lot of some of the surgery we do, you can't prepare for. So broken bones, mm-hmm. You know, people who come in through the emergency room, you don't have time to prepare. But fortunately, a lot of what we do is elective surgery, so there's lots of time for people to get ready. And part of it is that they have to make sure that they go through a medical checklist to make sure that everything is physically ready. But a lot of it is just physical and space requirements and rehab requirements, what they're going to need to know afterwards from a physical standpoint and also from a caregiver standpoint. So it's not just the patient getting ready, but it's the patient's family and loved ones who help them with their recovery, understanding the whole process. So there's in the process of going through education with our patients before surgery, we go over their whole recovery and set their expectations so that they know where they're going to be and what their limitations are at certain points, and then also involve the family in that too so that they understand how much of a responsibility driving, being able to get themselves medications they need, food, mobility, all those things play into their recovery.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we're talking about recommendations from the Patient Safety Committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons suggests that if you're going in for surgery, you have some questions to ask and you deserve to know the answers. So my guests are Dr. William Robbie, chair of the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons Patient Safety Committee, and also Dr. Joel Politi. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Mount Carmel East. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, like I said earlier, I'm one of those people that go in for the pre-op thing and walk out and say, I don't even know, have any idea what he just said. Dr. Rob, I mean, is that, are doctors, surgeons taught, or are they working on learning more about whether or not the patient really heard what they said?
Sure. So we actually know a lot more about this than we did, 10 or 15 years ago. We know that patient recall from a setting in which surgery is discussed is substantially diminished. The discussion, the recall from the immediate discussion, if it's in an office setting or if it's in an emergency room or a hospital setting, all of those settings negatively impact the ability for recall, and then the further the patient is removed from that immediate episode in which the discussions took place, we know the recall drops even further. We also know that the type of patient and the setting in which the patient is supported by their family or friends really also impacts that recall. So if it's an older patient who's alone, mm-hmm. and may have some challenges in terms of communication, we know that there's much less recall from that almost immediately, whereas a younger patient with family and friends helping them to remember what was critical information at the time of the communication, there's much more recall, and it's sustained over a longer period of time. And we know that this all impacts actually the outcomes of surgery as well.
Dr. Politi, at Mount Carmel East, say you have an elderly patient in who doesn't seem to have anybody. Is there a social worker? Is there somebody that can be their buddy during this kind of a process?
Yeah, so, when we're in the planning phases of this, there are a lot of elderly who unfortunately are just not supported well from a social family standpoint. So we try to involve them in the process along the way and ways that we provide them with help and connection with the system. So there's a case manager in the hospital who helps to facilitate their everything that they need. And most of those people on a major surgery are going to wind up going to a rehab facility because they need somebody around with them. But in the process of preparation, we have them go to, in joint replacement world, we have them go to a joint replacement class ahead of time so they get familiar with the environment. We give them lots of written literature, and then also there's a lot of shock factor when people make a decision to have surgery. Mm-hmm. And as Dr. Rob said, once the initial idea of having surgery enters their head, a lot of the other details just start washing away. So as much information that they can get that's in a written format is really helpful, but then also repetition. So we have people come back and go to a class where they're educated more and get involved and start talking with the case manager at mm-hmm. that meeting. And it's the same case manager that they deal with when they're in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And some level of continuity, familiar faces, makes them feel comfortable. And then they start planning, and we have them talk to a rehab facility before the surgery, again, to make them just more involved in the process, and then they understand where they're going, and they have familiar faces when they get there as well.
Now, you both sound like a couple of really nice guys, but sometimes patients think that their doctors aren't listening to them and that they are don't want to have to bother with the small talk with a patient. And I should say not small talk, but talking to a layperson about what the deal is. What can patients do if they think their doctor isn't listening to them, Dr. Rob?
So actually, this was the focus of our National Academy 10 years ago. We understood actually that patients' perceptions of surgeons were challenging. And for more than 10 years, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons has held educational programs for surgeons to help them better communicate with patients. Communication isn't a skill that is traditionally taught in medical schools or in residency programs. Actually, orthopedics is unique among surgical specialties in that it's had a program now for 10 years to really provide education to surgeons about how to do this effectively. There are techniques in which you can provide better communication, particularly in critical circumstances. They're used in other industries, critical care industries, such as pilots, so forth and so on, communicating with their crew. But one of the ways that you can help a person understand is simple and obvious, but you can say, can you repeat what I just said to you? We know that actually if you ask a patient to say back to you or write back to you what you just said, we know that retention goes up and understanding goes way up. So they're just a simple example, but there are many techniques actually that are teachable to surgeons and their teams to help with this communication, particularly in the surgical setting.
Dr. Politi, is there a line between asking questions and pestering a doctor? Have you felt pestered by patients before?
Well, I guess that's a sensitive subject
it
for
is.
Patients, but you know, the patient shouldn't feel ever that they're pestering. That should be the take-home point, is that there are certainly personality types which lend themselves more to what you just said, pestering, rather than just or some people kind of perseverate over things and just want to repetitively ask the same question and so we still are going to answer those questions and make the patient feel as if they're comfortable, because their recovery is definitely inhibited if they don't feel comfortable with the whole process. So part of what we try and do is on our side is we've got a very good support network set up, and a lot of the surgery that we do and a lot of the recovery we do is very routine, and it is very you can script it ahead of time very well. So in our practice, we have a very good support staff of nurses and physician assistants and nurse practitioners and case managers, and they all understand the process really well. So we give the patient lots of opportunity to ask and be answered the questions correctly, and almost always you can get them to feel comfortable with the process. And as a surgeon, I want them to feel comfortable with me and the process. And then as a patient, they need to understand what they're in for and what their expectations are. So the end answer to your question is the patient shouldn't worry about pestering if they don't feel like they've gotten the answer.
Getting the most out of a pre-op office visit requires that the patients, that we be prepared to give the physician certain information to. And like what? Dr. Robb, how can we come to the office prepared? Should we bring a notebook and a pen?
Well, sure. I think there are a couple things. You need to prepare for the visit. I wouldn't just show up in the office and sort of do last-minute questions. Think about your visit, what you intend to accomplish, what you think you're going to need, and bring those materials with you. Try and come with someone else, particularly if there's going to be a critical conversation. And finally, if you go to the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, you can just search AAOS.org or .org. Search under patient safety. There's a lot of materials available on the web through the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and other reputable organizations that are concerned about surgical safety. And they actually outline very nicely 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 bullet points that are important things to bring, certainly for a pre-op visit, but even just for normal office visits that may not involve surgical decision making. And so I encourage people to use the internet, particularly to get that information available. It's very understandable, and I think helps people sort of template better what they're going to need and be prepared for their physician's visits.
How transferable is that information to between specialties? Because you mentioned that the Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons is kind of ahead of the game on this issue. Would it be helpful for other kinds of surgeries?
you know, much of it is not specific to orthopedics. The Academy's website for patients, orthoinfo.org, actually has some general information, which is applicable to almost any type of surgery. But then it also drills down if you're having a specific operation like a hip replacement or a spine surgery. Then there's additional information available that might be specific to that particular procedure. There are also some patient safety organizations that actually have information, obviously, that's patient-focused, and that's generally not specific to certain procedures, but is important information just about your general health and preparation, such as illnesses that may affect your outcome or lifestyle issues, obesity, smoking habits, drinking, various medications, so forth and so on. All of these things can impact your surgical outcome.
Sometimes, particularly older people, are afraid to question what a doctor or a nurse is doing. They're intimidated by it. And I remember my dad was going in for a procedure that he shouldn't have had because he had a pacemaker on and he didn't want to say anything. And I finally stopped him and said, wait a minute, he has a pacemaker on. You can't do that. People feel intimidated by that. And I was wondering, Dr. Politi, if you have any tips for people on getting over that.
Yeah, so I think that patients need the intimidation factor is real, and some people are better at expressing themselves than others. And, you know, a couple of things that I think the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons has done a great job on being patient advocates and trying to, you know, we promote lots of checks and balances along the way to make sure that we have safe surgery for our patients. But it's all hands on deck when we're going through the procedure to make sure that everybody is held responsible for quality. And the patient and the family certainly are part of that team. So if there's a question that the patient has about something that's being done to them, and this would be with surgery, but it would be with anything, a procedure, if they're in physical therapy and they question why somebody's doing something, mm-hmm. it's okay to ask the question. And I think that sometimes this is where family can also play a really good role. You gave a good example of your father, but I think that when patients are going through this, sometimes they're involved and they can't see the process mm-hmm. as well. And family really plays a big role in this and can be very helpful.
All right. Well, Dr. Joel Politi, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
You bet. Thank you.
Dr. Joel Politi, he's an orthopedic surgeon at Orthopedic One and Mount Carmel East. And also Dr. William Robb, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. William Robb, he's the chair of the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons Patient Safety Committee, and we will post that website online at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most of us associate a coach with sports, and you've probably heard of the life coach trend by now. Now there are health coaches, and no, they don't bench you when you forget your vegetables or take the elevator instead of the stairs. Amy Marsloff is a health coach based here in Columbus, and she's in the studio to tell us more about this emerging field and who might benefit from a little coaching. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you, Ann.
So, all right, what is a health coach? Is it like a nutritionist, or is it a physical therapist, or a combination? How do you define it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a vague, broad range of a word as a health coach. You could, personally for me, so I'll speak for me.
Okay.
As a health coach, I help my clients get healthier via food. We start with nutrition, but we also look into various other areas of their life, like their careers. Do they love what they're doing? Do they feel passion waking up every morning to go to work? Their exercise, do they move their body in a way that feels good to them? Their spirituality, do they connect to something higher than themselves? And of course, the food they're eating. So that's what I, as a health coach, do. But there are other health coaches who actually will be like a patient advocate between doctor and patient.
Like we were just talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like I'm a patient advocate. I am a mentor, accountability coach,
okay,
support. I help take the overwhelm out of living a healthy, balanced life. And again, other health coaches might have more clinical. So a nutritionist could be categorized as a health coach. There are dietitians who are specifically dietitians, but also are doing more health coaching, not necessarily in the hospital working with meal plans.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Amy Marsloff. She's a health coach. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So it is kind of spongy. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's out there looking for some health coaching, are there certifications for it? Is there some kind of standard bearer out there that we can look for?
Yeah, it is spongy, as you say. And there's a lot of different certifications, a lot of different programs out there. And it depends what the client wants. Does the client have more medical conditions? And if that's the case, I personally, as a patient, would want somebody who has more experience, more clinical.
Where would you find them? How would you know?
That's a great question. Obviously, the Google search is okay. Where I'd start.
Uh-huh. Do hospital social workers, do people, doctors recommend them?
Definitely, as you're saying, uh-huh. Definitely being, it's much a growing field.
Uh-huh.
And so there are referrals, there are hospitals working with health coaches, there are chiropractors, physicians, because in the realm that I work, doctors don't have enough time to spend with their patients. Many know that nutrition's important, but they don't have the time to coach them through.
This is part of the whole wellness piece of healthcare. Instead of waiting until you're sick,
yeah,
this is that in front of the game piece.
Exactly. Yeah.
What when we talk about certification, what kind of training does that require? How do you get certified?
Yeah. There's anything from 4-week certification to 4 years of certification. And it just depends on the health coach you're going with. Personally, mine was a year long mm-hmm. certification, and there's nutritional education, there's learning how to coach and work, and also the business side of it, how to make
a living out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have refresher courses? Do you need to update your certification?
I don't personally. But I do.
Anyway.
Anyway, yes, just because it's my passion. Mm-hmm. I love learning more about nutrition and wellness and balanced living and how.
How'd you end up getting into this field? Yeah. Did you start out as something, one thing, and it just morphed into this kind of larger mission?
Yeah. I was dying a slow corporate death many years ago.
Okay.
And yeah, I was to a place where I knew that God had given me so much, and I just wasn't shining my light. I was hiding behind a computer, and so I just started praying about it and asking, where do I belong? Because I didn't even know my passions at this time. I knew I loved health and cooking and wellness and fitness and the outdoors and spirituality, but that was just who I was. That was just me. I didn't know you could make a career out of it.
So that's interesting. You came out to it from left field in a way.
Yeah.
Other people start out as nutritionists or physical therapists or exercise trainers, that kind of thing, and find their way that way.
Yeah, absolutely. That many nurses will go into it. And as you said, physical therapists, trainers. I came out because of desperation of not loving what I did and not stepping into my greatest self.
What sort of people benefit from a coach? Is it everybody? Do they are there some people that you think just aren't good at taking advice or aren't good working with a coach and they're probably not the right client?
Every health coach I know has their own niche, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There are definitely people who are not coachable.
Okay.
I ideally don't want to work with somebody who's not coachable. And so I will be able to know within 15 minutes of a conversation with somebody if they're really ready to step it up. So repeat your question again.
Well, just if there's some people that aren't suited, they just personality-wise, they're not. I think the way you said it is, if they're, and what would you do then? I mean, if you see that someone's not coachable, they've come to you for help, and you're like, what do you say to them?
There's two different scenarios. One is that I work with, let's say, a woman, and she's like, oh, my husband needs to come see you. And so he's coming under the push and shove of his wife.
Yeah.
And he's not game. He's not in. Yeah. So that's not somebody who I want to drag along.
Right.
I put it back on him and ask him or her, what do they want? What do they really want? If you could get what you really wanted right now in this moment, in the next 90 days, what do you want? So I try to get a bigger why for them. So I try to get them to see that, oh, maybe I could benefit from this. Because when I am taking care of my health and eating well, I have more energy and I have more focus and clarity and I feel good in my clothes.
You mentioned 90 days.
Uh-huh.
Is that a typical span of time that a health coach would work with somebody?
90 days is my typical.
Okay.
But I have a 28-day jump start where we can get a lot of momentum. 90 days, we go deeper. I have six-month clients. I have clients who come back and do another 6 months. So there's never lack of information, lack of coaching.
You can always keep learning.
Yeah.
If I have a purely psychological issue, it's a mental health issue, are you the right health coach for me, or would you refer that out to someone else?
And mental health, what do you mean by mental health?
Depression.
Depression.
That's going untreated elsewhere.
I would always personally prefer somebody's working with a therapist, because I'm not a therapist. I can... nutrition can definitely play a key role in helping with depression and mental disease,
mental illness.
Illness, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't rule it out by any means that I couldn't help them, but I also am smart enough to know that it's out of my realm of expertise and I need the support. I need them to be getting the support that they need so that they're taken care of.
Right.
But nutrition definitely can affect many areas. One of my favorite books out there is called The Ultra Mind Solution by Mark Hyman. And he is addressing bipolar, depression, Alzheimer's, all through nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Amy Marsloff, she is a health coach based in Columbus. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you've ever wondered what one does, we can talk about what Amy does. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So where does exercise fit in? Are coaches typically personal trainers?
They can be, but not necessarily. I'm personally not a personal trainer.
Okay.
I joke. I say exercise is my Prozac. So exercise is a big piece of, I believe, of a wellness program and of being your optimal self. It doesn't mean you have to go to the gym. If you don't like the gym, let's find an exercise that feels great for your body. I like pairing up and making it a social activity and a movement or a physical activity.
How often do you find people are sort of miscast in how they're pursuing a healthy lifestyle? they're exercising all the time, but they're not getting any benefit from it. They're dieting all the time, but they can't seem to lose the weight.
Yeah. There's been a lot of misinformation, and we're learning more and more every day. So one time we thought that you had to do an hour of cardio every day to get the results that you wanted. What now studies are showing is that actually that's more harm than good. So there's a lot of maybe updated information that's not getting delivered to people to make healthy eating, healthy living, realistic, sustainable, manageable. You don't have to spend an hour, hour and a half in the gym every day. So, and from a food perspective too, there's foods out there that we've deemed healthy. We think they're good for us. Mm-hmm. Like eggs. Are they good or are they not? They have high cholesterol. Or are they a great source of protein? You know, so there's a lot of confusion with nutrition.
Well, I mean, some people, they could just pick up a book. They could, you know, listen to my show every week. There's a lot of ways you can get health information. How much does it cost to work with a health coach? And why would it make a difference to work with a health coach?
Yeah. First of all, there's a lot of information out there.
Right.
And it's overwhelming. Which way do you go? And how many diets have we tried? And they're not sustainable. So to work with a health coach is getting you the right plan, the right support, and the accountability. And that's what it takes for success, whether it's business coaching, health coaching. So working with a health coach can range anywhere from $300 to... Oh my gosh, I have peers who charge $10,000 for VIP days. So I'm...
Wow.
Yeah, it's a broad range. Yeah, yeah. I'm not there.
Yeah.
nor do I think I ever want to even be there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I want to make it more accessible for people who want to who really have a genuine interest of getting healthier, feeling happier, stepping into their life and their brightest light.
So you're looking for a health coach, you know, you Google, you start the usual ways, the proverbial yellow pages search, which isn't really part of the matrix these days, and you find out what their certification is, what their specialty is maybe, and you tell them what you're looking for, and you ask them how much it's going to cost to see if it fits into your budget, right? Those are all the things you kind of typically
do. Yeah. If you have a more chronic symptom, make sure that they're trained in that. And if they aren't, then maybe they're partnering up with someone. Oftentimes, I will work with clients. We'll start with nutrition, knowing that perhaps it's bigger than me. Hormones, bigger than me. But also, food affects hormones. So if we can introduce foods that are going to shift hormones, great. Oftentimes, the hormones are stronger than nutrition. So I have my go-to people who I call in, the big dogs, when I can't do my magic.
What is the protocol for clients? Do you talk on the phone? Do you talk in person? Do you start out with a free consultation? How does that work?
Yep. I always start out with a free consultation. They're interviewing me as much as I'm interviewing them.
And that's pretty typical in the field?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is. And I have clients across the country, and I also work live.
So you go by phone and in person.
Yep. And I'm meeting in my office, or I'm meeting in my kitchen. I'm meeting in their kitchen. We're cleaning out their pantry.
How often do you find that you're actually a life coach?
More often than I am a health coach. Yeah.
That it's a whole... holistic approach.
It's a holistic approach. It's really interesting. One of the paradigms I use in my coaching is how you do one thing is how you do everything. So how you do food is really how you do money and how you do your relationships. And that paradigm had to grow on me. And now that it's obvious to me how I am in this area of my life, I'm also that way in that area of my life. It's great. And it's
Good way to get people thinking about themselves in other terms.
Yeah.
Well, Amy Marsloff, thanks for joining us today to talk about
Thank
it. You did
Anne.
A great job.
Thank you so much.
Amy Marsloff, she is a health coach. We've been talking about that and many other things on Wellness Wednesday today, so you can listen again tonight if you want at 8 p.m. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.